You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff finished his week-long tour of the Pacific, we discuss the potential for conflict between America and China in the South China Sea.
The issue is, I suppose, made more urgent because of the discovery of good resources. And so I think that has really kind of given China an added impetus. And it's also made the other contesting parties even more aware of what's at stake.
As the legendary yet old-fashioned Spirit Pernod begins a rebrand, we ask whether spirits with a staid reputation need to bring in the branding experts or simply find a good barman. Our colleagues from Wing Creative will be on hand to give us their view, and we'll also rustle up some cocktails under expert supervision in the Midori House kitchen.
Cheers.
And as if that's not enough, we'll also have the fourth in our special series on cities, what makes them great and what can make them better. Our editor Andrew Tuck sits down with Pierre Mordet, Mayor of Geneva, and there's also a discussion about diplomatic cities.
An ambassador to this mini-state, it looks like Ruritania from the outside, the Swiss guards, the costumes, the ceremonial, but it's also being ambassador to this extraordinary global network and the world's oldest international organisation.
All that, plus I'll play you a song. All coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has urged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to hand over power and leave his country. Speaking at a news conference in Istanbul, Mrs. Clinton said Syria would not see peace until Mr. Assad departed. She said it was vital to give the Kofi Annan peace plan a chance to work.
We think it is important for us to give Kofi Annan and his plan the last amount of support that we can muster, because in order to bring others into a frame of mind to take action in the Security Council, there has to be a final recognition that it's not working.
Meanwhile, a United Nations supervision mission in Syria spokeswoman has said UN observers had not been able to enter Marzat al-Kubair, where activists say at least 78 villages had been massacred by forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The spokeswoman, Sarsan Ghoshesh, said the mission had been obstructed by three factors.
The first, we've been stopped by at Syrian army checkpoints and at some points turned back. The second is that we were stopped by civilians in the area. They stopped our cars from proceeding going forward. The third is that we got information and phone calls from residents in the area saying that the security of our observers is at risk.
The Justice Ministry in Iraq has said one of Saddam Hussein's closest aides, who handed down many of the dictator's repressive orders, has been executed. The man, Abed Hamoud, was Saddam's private secretary and was regarded by many Iraqis as more influential than most ministers. Croatia's environment minister, Mirela Holu, has resigned over an email in which she asked the head of the state railway company to keep the wife of a party colleague in her job. Mrs. Holu said she was stepping down over the political damage caused by the release of the email she sent in March. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has met British Prime Minister David Cameron in Berlin for a discussion on the euro crisis. Mr. Cameron said that although Britain was not in the single currency, he was fully aware of how important it was for Eurozone countries to tackle the issues that were affecting European stability.
I have no doubt that the single currency countries will want to seek greater integration. That is clearly going to happen over the coming months and years. Britain's not in the single currency. We won't be joining the single currency, so we won't take part in that integration. But we know that it's necessary for the single currency to deal with these issues so that it can work properly in the future.
Officials in Peru say a helicopter with foreign nationals on board has gone missing in the south of the country. The helicopter left the Amazon region of Madre de Dios on Wednesday evening, heading for Cusco, but there are no reports of it having landed. There are also reports of a cargo plane going missing in Uruguay. The plane with two crew on board was en route from the capital, Montevideo, to Buenos Aires in Argentina when radio and radar contact was lost shortly after takeoff. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much. It is 21:05 in Moscow, 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, és Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Willkommen till Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λονδόστε Κασίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, ez a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, είναι Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que está acontecendo é Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você escuta Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Hagatja.
The chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, was in Thailand on Wednesday, the last stop on a week-long trip through the Pacific, which underlined the importance with which President Barack Obama is treating the region. The US is keen to lend support to a handful of nations in Southeast Asia that are increasingly worried about China's intentions within the region. Many analysts fear that long simmering disputes within the South China Sea threaten to blow up into full-blown skirmishes. A little earlier, I headed down to Chatham House in the heart of London to meet Kerry Brown, head of the think tank's Asia programme. So if we look at what's happening in the South China Sea right now, with a sort of standoff between China and the US, both are sort of involved in various ways, what is it fundamentally that China actually wants?
Well, I mean, its historic claims, well, they're, you know, they've been around for a long time and they'll probably be around for a long time. The issue is, I suppose, made more urgent because of the discovery of good resources in some of these maritime areas. And so I think that has really kind of given China a kind of added impetus. And it's also made the other contesting parties, you know, the Philippines, Vietnam, Japan, even more, and Taiwan, I suppose, but in a very specific way, even more aware of what's at stake. Without the resource issues, I think, you know, it would be a case of slow diplomacy and it may be something that would take a long, long, long time to sort out. But now, because of an awareness of, you know, what is potentially available in terms of resources in these places, become much more kind of urgent.
How does that then translate into what China does there?
Well, I suppose it has two choices. It's either going to continue a diplomatic route where everyone gets together and bit by bit they inch towards a viable diplomatic outcome, or, which sporadically happens, there's provocation, China pushes its cause, others push their cause, there's potential conflicts, some of these have already happened. It starts with low skirmishes, like with the you know, the Japanese lifeboats, which were clashing with a Chinese vessel last year. All sorts of little skirmishes. The problem with that kind of approach is that it's kind of trying to deal with it by proxy. You know, you let other lower level actors try and deal with, try and sort of see how far you can push things, but it could really get out of hand because feelings are running quite high. The Japanese ambassador in Beijing today said the kind of proposal by the governor of Tokyo, who is a very well-known nationalist, to you know, purchase the Spratly Islands. This sort of gestural politics is likely to figure, but it could go badly wrong.
The US has made it quite clear that they want to be involved and they will, you know, help it to a certain extent anyway, sort of back up their allies. You know, the Joint Chief of Staff was in, the Defence Chief of Staff was in Thailand this week. Do you think the US is in the region for the long haul?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's sort of two aspects. One is, many Chinese believe that there's a strategy of containment, and that this is America's sort of gambit to contain and thwart and frustrate China's powers. But I think actually to America, its fear is that there would be a sort of contagious aggressiveness throughout the region, that contesting parties wouldn't be able to control their actions, and that this could really become an enormous problem. So they feel that they're giving a security blanket. It's a question of interpretation. Many Chinese would look at it and think this is America kind of pushing itself in where it's not wanted, not needed. But I think many other strategic thinkers would say, without America there as a sort of honest broker, there could be real escalations. And, you know, and I think most of the parties, in some senses, they kind of like the American presence. China's probably the least likely to like it because it's probably the most, it's the one with the most to gain, and also the one with probably the most sort of clout now.
If push comes to shove, do you think China is willing to take any sort of military action, you know, within South China Sea? And if so, has the capability to do so successfully?
There's a big unknowns. China's military capability is really untested because it hasn't had combat experience since 1979. So, of course, it's got lots of good new kit in a way, but in terms of combat experience, it's very, very inexperienced. I don't think that there would be a strategic intent to lead to this. China says that it wants the People's Liberation Army to be able to fight localized wars to promote its interests if necessary, but it wants a defensive rather than an offensive capacity. If there was a sort of conflict, I'm sure that would be caused by a miscalculation, by misunderstanding, and kind of by a sort of series of steps that lead bit by bit towards the conflict. It wouldn't be something I think that China would see in its interests. The only real reason it would defend such sort of offensiveness is if it felt that it was being pushed into a corner where its interests were so impeded that it couldn't do anything else.
That was Carrie Brown, head of the Asia programme at Chatham House, talking to me a little bit earlier. And you can hear the rest of that interview on tomorrow morning's edition of The Foreign Desk, which airs during The Globalist at 7 a.m. London time. We'll also be talking about Afghanistan and the future of defence. So well worth tuning in for. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be rustling up a cocktail or two, and we'll also have a little song.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
And you really are all invited to the Monocle Country Fair. I hope to see you there. I'm going to play you a song now. This is National Anthem by the lovely Lana Del Rey. That was Lana Del Rey, and you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One. Now, in the 80 years since Paul Ricard cooked up the first batch of the anise liquor that would bear his name, the recipe for serving it hasn't changed. Mix one part Ricard, or Pernod, with five parts water to create a pale yellow opaque concoction, traditionally drunk as an aperitif. It's not a drink that's aged well with young consumers, which is why it's playing a rebrand that it hopes will appeal to a new generation. A little earlier, we invited head bartender James Stevenson from Pearl, a neighbouring cocktail bar in London's Marylebone, to demonstrate how clever mixing can revitalise any liquor. So, James, we're here in the kitchen at Midori House with a fine selection of, is it fair to say, not necessarily the most fashionable of beverages?
I'd agree. So I'm going to make you a Corks Reviver number 2, which is a classic Savoy cocktail. With sort of programmes like Mad Men, Boardwalk Empire, it's sort of had a bit of a new lease of life. It's a mixture of Plymouth Gin, Lillet Blanc, which is a French fortified wine from Bordeaux, sort of a classic example of a sweet French white vermouth.
Sort of a drink that is perhaps a little bit of a hard sell at times.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's there's probably about 20, 25 herbs in there, so it's quite floral, quite herbaceous. So, I mean, you wouldn't really want it over ice. And then we've got Cointreau, which is, people who don't know, is a brandy-based orange liqueur.
And then you've also got what I thought was a little sort of air freshener thing, but is actually absinthe.
That's right, in a
tiny plastic bottle with a little sort of spray thing on top.
Like I said before, I mean, it's for the gentleman on the go, it's always handy to have absinthe in a small container.
Oh, absinthe.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, absinthe as well, it's such a strong anise taste. That is also something that I find people tend to steer away from, that kind of very heavy licorice kind of taste. So, like I say, Corks Reviver number 2 from the Savoy cocktail book. So this drink is a lot older than I am. Its popularity was 1920s. The thing that people think about when they think about cocktails, people drinking out of coupettes, flappers, you know, sort of Great Gatsby kind of style. Basically going to do equal parts of each one, so 15 Plymouth, 15 Cointreau, 15 Lillet.
Let's have a sniff that.
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, blimey.
It's a very acquired taste.
Yeah, it really is.
And then 25 of lemon, just because most of our ingredients are quite sweet. Cointreau, extremely sugary, extremely sweet. And then Lillet Blanc, which is a vermouth that is really on the sweet side.
And so if you're, I mean, do you often find that you're using, you know, different drinks, different spirits that are perhaps not quite as popular as now as they perhaps used to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sort of premise of our bar, we take sort of historical drink references and basically bring them into a new light, put a spin on them so they become more palatable to our taste. Because obviously we have quite sweet palates these days, whereas in the past, something like gin, extremely dry, you'd probably just have it on ice.
So you think it's got more to do with the fact that our palate has changed rather than that certain drinks go in and out of style?
I think so, yeah. I mean, sort of in the 1980s when drinks had a bit of a revival, sort of films like Cocktail and Tom Cruise and all that kind of stuff, like horrific blue, multicoloured drinks that are layered on top of each other. You know, people wanted a sweet drink. I mean, even with sort of fast food today, it's you know, all our food's a lot more sweetened than it used to be. So yeah, it's just about presenting interesting ingredients that people might not, maybe haven't heard of or not familiar with, and then making them palatable. I'm gonna have to shake this, or
Are you finding that with the whole kind of molecular mixology and that kind of movement having happened, and you're now talking about cocktails, you know, from 1920s, 1960s. Do you think there's a kind of a move away from that, a rejection of all that, the really kind of esoteric fancy stuff that's happened in the last few years that happened with, along with the food movement with Heston and people, the same thing happened with cocktails. Do you think there's now a return to something which is slightly more old school, more classic?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's quite shamelessly plugging my own bar, but that's exactly what we do there.
Shall we have a taste of this now? You've put it into very, very nice little glasses with a sort of bit of a cockerel on as well.
Cockerel, yeah, quite kitsch 1950s glass. So I'll let you try it like that, and then I'm going to atomize some absinthe on top. So you can see the beauty of the aroma of licorice and fennel with that drink.
Mm. Very lemony.
Yeah, tangy.
Yeah, really tangy.
Okay, so this is the absinthe.
So there we go, just a couple of squirts. That's more an aroma release. It's an absinthe mist.
It's quite a strong aroma.
Yeah, it's a strong aroma of absinthe. Cheers. That was James Stevenson, head bartender at Pearl Cocktail Bar. And you could also hear the dulcet tones of our business associate, Jonathan Openshaw, there as well. And he's in the studio now.
Complaining about absinthe loudly.
You were,
the absinthe mist.
The absinthe myth, you weren't a fan.
Well, it was slightly earlier in the day when we did that.
It was. Also joining us in the studio now to discuss Pernod Ricard's rebrand is Adam Thompson from Monocle's sister company, the international design and branding agency, Wink Creative. Adam, thank you for popping down from the second floor.
You're welcome.
So we have a bottle of Ricard right in front of us. Jonathan, let's not pour it out just yet. We can taste it in a moment.
Yeah.
But Adam, if you take a look at that bottle for a start, if you were advising the gentleman at Pernod Ricard right now, saying, look, this is what you need to do to appeal to either a younger demographic or to appeal just frankly to anyone again, mm-hmm. what would you be saying to them?
Well, I think they've done a really good job on the bottle redesign. I like the idea of having a square bottom to sort of stand out on the shelf. I think retaining elements of the classic design of Ricard was a really nice and astute move, and also I hear that they've retained the colour of the yellow and the blue for any of their marketing material, so water jugs and glasses and so forth. So kind of ploughing their heritage to good effect. In terms of what I think they need to do, I think currently they're not in popular culture, and they kind of have disappeared from any conversation. And I would suggest that they take a look at what the likes of Campari has done in terms of their involvement in Frank's Campari Bar in Peckham, which has been a very successful sponsorship for them and helped them become part of a conversation with a new generation of drinkers.
Jonathan, do you think they have to try and appeal to a younger demographic, or is it just about just appealing to people who might have drunk it when they were younger but now see it as a little bit old and staid?
I mean, I think it's about introducing new ways of drinking it as well and showing that it's something that you can, it's not just a bygone memory, it's something you can still have. I think going back to Campari, their sponsorships were effective, but also things like Negronis for Campari have been great, and and Aperol spritzers for Aperol as well. So it's a kind of introducing new ways to drink it, maybe ways that are more palatable to our tastes now, and it isn't that kind of full hit of something which tastes quite medicinal.
Do you want to, Jonathan, do the honours?
Okay.
And pour just a little bit. I think it's one part Ricard with five parts water.
I think so. Maybe I'm not sure if I'm going to quite do as good a job as James. I haven't got the same equipment.
Maybe go like heavy on the water, to be honest.
No way, Steve. Yours is straight.
I'm not sure about that. My problem with this is that I really don't like any sort of licorice-based drinks. Anyway, while Jonathan is doing that, I mean, Adam, do they, you say they've done quite a good job on redesigning the bottle. And they need to think more, but maybe about their advertising. I mean, is it possible there's just certain drinks that are just like sherry, impossible to sell really, and unless you're in a Spanish bar or in Spain itself, it really hasn't transitioned from being seen as an old person's drink.
Sure, I think that what they're lacking is an ownership of an occasion at the moment, and so if you look at something like sherry, actually that's. There's been, a rise in popularity of that drink in the last 5 years or so, and it's to do with being able to own a particular time or occasion. And sorry, I'm just amused by your face.
Yeah, I'm just sorry. I just took a whiff of the. We've got it now in front of us, and it is sort of as I said before, quite a sort of a pale yellow thing. Bottoms up, I guess. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah, I can't actually even drink that. I'm sorry. What do we
think?
It's
very sweet. It's just that it's that taste of licorice. It's that taste of Sambuca, which I'm sure not all of us have altogether good memories of. it's just, I can't imagine a drink that's going to really convince me that this is a nice kind of leisure drink for me.
Adam, do you think it's a case, as James was saying earlier, that you can take these old drinks and actually just once you're being creative with them, then that's when they really work?
I think... Absolutely,
the interview with the cocktail waiter was very interesting in that respect. I think he brought a new element to the drink. But I do think as well that it's about having confidence in your history and in terms of those occasions that you actually are going to be part of. So, you know, they should be looking at how they could be involved in pairing on menus in influential restaurants and that kind of side of things, as opposed to just worrying about how you can appeal to a younger consumer.
Adam Thompson from Upstairs at Wing Creative, Jonathan Openshaw, our business editor, thank you both very much. You're listening to Midori House.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afto in to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And that is all from this section of Midori House. It was produced by Dawn Trump, our researcher was Ben Jay, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and in the next half hour on Midori House, I'll be handing over to Andrew Tuck, who will be looking at diplomatic cities and also sitting down with the mayor of Geneva. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has urged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to hand over power and leave his country. Speaking at a news conference in Istanbul, Mrs. Clinton said Syria would not see peace until Mr. Assad departed. Meanwhile, a United Nations supervision mission in Syria spokeswoman has said UN observers had not been able to enter Masrat al-Kubair, where activists say at least 78 villagers had been massacred by forces loyal to Syrian President Assad. The Justice Ministry in Iraq has said one of Saddam Hussein's closest aides, who handed down many of the dictator's repressive orders, has been executed. The man, Abad Humed, was Saddam's private secretary and was regarded by many Iraqis as more influential than most ministers. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has met British Prime Minister David Cameron in Berlin for a discussion on the euro crisis. Mr. Cameron said that although Britain was not in the single currency, he was fully aware of how important it was for Eurozone countries to tackle the issues that were affecting European stability. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Today on our special cities series, we watch our words and play nicely, because it's all about diplomacy. We'll get an inside look at a city that has two sets of ambassadors as we take a trip to Rome and speak to Nigel Baker, the UK's ambassador to the Holy See.
I joke occasionally with my colleague, the ambassador to Italy, that although on the one hand I am an ambassador to, I think, the smallest country in the world, I'm also actually ambassador to the rest of the world, and even a little bit of what goes on above the world, given the nature of the Vatican.
And then we hear from the Deputy Director General of the WTO and why Geneva has seduced the world of international organisations. We'll also start in Geneva with an interview with the outgoing mayor, Pierre Maudet. Home to the who's who of the global bureaucracy, the WTO, the ILO, UNHCR, the IOM, and the more obscure OMM, that's the World's Meteorological Organization, Maudet has been in charge of a small city that's made its name by bringing in some of the biggest power players. I started by asking the mayor about how the city copes with so many migrants at every level of society.
Pour Genève, la migration a toujours été vue comme une chance plus que comme un risque.
For Geneva, immigration has always been seen as more of an opportunity than as a risk. We have a very strong foreign community who aren't just staying in the ghettos, but are implicating themselves in city life, who are participating in sporting, cultural and other activities, which are the best ways to integrate people. The difficulty, or the risk, that we have today is that we face a new wave of immigration, essentially economic, that we encountered since the end of last year. The challenge for the municipality is to measure and accept up until a certain point a certain number of immigrants, if possible with the capacity to integrate, notably on a larger economic level, and then the same for the others. It's to manage on a global level. The role of opinion is about to be surpassed because immigration is a global issue.
Do you think the impression of Geneva is mistaken in the outside world? Because I think many people think that Geneva is a very traditional, conservative city. And in many ways, it sounds though you have the problems of any modern city and the same challenges as any modern city. Is that true? And I think also you said that, for example, it's only in recent years that you've had any begging on the streets of Geneva. So is it a time of change maybe for Geneva?
Alors, Genève est une ville qui est en train de changer. Et son image de ville traditionnelle est à la fois vraie et fausse.
Geneva is a city that is in the process of changing. Its image as a traditional city at the same time, both true and false. The larger agglomeration of Geneva now includes over 500,000 inhabitants, which is bringing a new dynamic to the city, a capacity few Swiss cities have, creating new jobs and attracting companies. But there's also a paradox. The city has an image that it is resting while things go past, and in some cases is sleeping, but then at other moments or in other areas, is completely in high gear. It's incredible to see the strength today in the entire region, but particularly in Geneva, when it comes to developing technology. I'm thinking particularly of CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research, and the medical research presence in Geneva. This shows that this city is one of the most advanced in specific areas of research. At the same time, we are a city with a rich heritage that we perhaps don't value enough. Like you said, Geneva has the same problems as any other major city. With a population of 500,000 people, we have challenges in areas such as security. Geneva has for too long been viewed as the smallest of the big cities. It is quickly becoming a larger city, and to maintain the standard we are familiar with, we have to innovate. That's the challenge for me. To get the city to wake up in areas of security, entertainment and investment, not only in the traditional branches such as finance and watchmaking, but also in new branches.
And can you tell me that one of the things we've been discussing while we've been here in Geneva is the role of the city acting almost independently of the state that's around it. But for you, you have an interesting situation, which is you're only 20 minutes from the border with France. So in a way, what's happening in France, if there's different policies there, it affects Geneva. So if there's a crime wave in France, it could spill over into Geneva. Do you find that you can isolate yourself as a city, or do you have to work with what's happening across the border in France and what's happening elsewhere in Switzerland?
Non, aujourd'hui les villes ne peuvent pas s'isoler, se considérer pour elles-mêmes, elles sont dans un environnement.
Today, cities can no longer isolate themselves. Instead, they have to consider themselves as part of a larger environment. The relation between the city and its surrounding areas is essential. Moreover, because it concerns the quality of life, the ability to leave the city to go to the countryside, for example. The dynamism of our region on the economic level is sometimes hampered by border politics, by our different ways of operating, and by the decisions made in Paris that have an impact throughout all of France, especially regarding issues of crime, which can have a real impact in Geneva. Everyday governing can be a real challenge because we have to bear with the decisions made elsewhere. Geneva is historically a city which has been built on belief, in the belief of the Red Cross, the belief of international humanitarian causes. It's a rare European city in the sense that it built a cathedral on its hill instead of a fortress. It placed belief above war. And that, for me, is the challenge of the 21st century. We've broken down the barriers of the 19th century. Now we have to break down the barriers, notably between France and Switzerland, that remain in our minds. More Europe and more regional collaboration to allow this city to develop further. And regarding the traffic problem on the border, we need to ease crossings and make the border more fluid.
Looking at those organizations that have come to Geneva for over many years, it's interesting that Geneva seems to have a more interventionist way of making sure that they stay here. So, for example, the World Trade Organization is not very far from where we're sitting, and the city of Geneva went out of its way to make it possible for them to expand their building, even offering them a loan to be able to do that. Is that surprising in modern Europe to find a city so willing to kind of engage with this kind of level of support to attract organizations?
La tradition de Genève, c'est d'accueillir les organisations. Et la bonne nouvelle,
Geneva's tradition has been to welcome organizations, and the good news is that this is a domain where we have understood that nothing belongs to anyone. So there is no guarantee that these organizations will still be here tomorrow. As a result, there is important work to be done every day to keep attracting and retaining these organizations. The advantage for these organizations to be in Geneva is being in an extraordinary place where diplomats, officials, and NGOs are already established. Our focus is to have a strong concentration and variety of agencies in every sector, and that is what we are working on. Housing is particularly a challenge today, and this is one of the areas we are focusing heavily on in order to keep international organizations here.
And I wanted to ask you about that housing situation. The most common complaint seems to be for people living in Geneva is just so expensive. Is that a downside of being a successful city? And is there anything that you, does it worry you that in fact most people find it very difficult to find somewhere to live that they can afford?
Oui, bien sûr que je suis préoccupé par cette situation.
Yes, of course, I'm quite concerned about the issue, primarily because it creates a tension between the locals of Geneva and the people that come, for example, in the context of international organizations and companies. Today, the multinational corporations are mostly being blamed for the housing crisis. My role as mayor is to diffuse these tensions and to prevent the situation from boiling over between the locals and those of the international Geneva, composed of NGOs and MNCs. Geneva is a bit behind for all types of housing, not only social housing, but also private housing. We are close to catching up, but it will take time.
And finally, if Geneva was a brand and you were selling Geneva around the world, what do you think are the best assets about modern Geneva that would attract companies, visitors, and also make the people who live here feel happy that they're here?
Je crois que le slogan qu'on a actuellement en français, il est pas très bon, mais en anglais, il est
There's a great slogan right now that sounds even better in English, actually, than in French, and that's Geneva is a world of its own. In Geneva, you will find a miniature world with incredible diversity. It is a bit of a paradox we're telling people to come to Geneva to feel at home in a way. However, here they will find an extraordinary mix of languages, cultures, origins and nationalities, while being in a place that still retains its own culture and tradition. In Geneva, you will find a miniature world with incredible diversity. It is a bit of a paradox we're telling people to come to Geneva to feel at home in a way. However, here they will find an extraordinary mix of languages, cultures, origins and nationalities while being in a place that still retains its own culture and tradition.
That was me speaking to Pierre Madet in Geneva.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Next, it's off to Rome, a capital that has a double set of diplomats, home to missions to Italy and also to the Vatican. David Willey caught up with the UK's ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker, to find out what it's like to be a diplomat in a city-state within another city.
I joke occasionally with my colleague, the ambassador to Italy, that although on the one hand I am ambassador to, I think, the smallest country in the world, and he is ambassador to one of the great powers, I'm also actually ambassador to the rest of the world, and even a little bit of what goes on above the world, given the nature of the Vatican, whereas he actually focuses specifically on Italian issues. The point being that, yes, I'm ambassador to this mini state. It looks like Ruritania from the outside, the Swiss guards, the costumes, the ceremonial, but it's also being ambassador to this extraordinary global network, which has, at the latest count, something like 1.2 billion adherents, and the world's oldest international organization. One passes monuments to the predecessors of the current head of government, who happens to be the Pope, and these predecessors go back, of course, to St. Peter. So this is a significant line of continuous succession of the government to which you're accredited, which no other government is able to offer to their ambassadors accredited to their country. And it's an organization that understands that history, that has that lengthy perspective. Most governments that British ambassadors are accredited to operate around electoral cycles, the next 4 years, the next couple of years, even the next month or so. Whereas the Vatican, the Holy See, is an organization that operates on the basis of centuries. And as a diplomat, you have to adjust your own perspective accordingly.
Can you describe the physical circumstances when you go, for example, to see the Pope? I don't suppose you go to see the boss very often, but when you go for consultations with his senior advisors, what does it all look like? How do you get into the Vatican? Is the security terribly difficult to get through?
Certainly, if you didn't have a CD plate on the car, and if the Swiss guards on the gate didn't recognise the car and the people you're driving with, it would be difficult to get in. As all other diplomats, I'm based outside because there's no room for embassies within the Vatican City State. But for a regular meeting at the Secretariat of State, the foreign ministry equivalent, we will drive into the main Vatican gates, usually swing round the back of St. Peter's. It's always a bit of a thrill, a bit of a privilege to enter into the confines of the Vatican City State, and then into one of the inner courtyards, in this particular case, a courtyard called St. Damaso Courtyard, and go up to the Secretariat of State, which is rather extraordinary, and one never ceases to be amazed. Over time, one does this journey. Because you take the lift up, you find yourself walking down a corridor that's been decorated by Raphael, not any old interior decorator, and his colleagues, with extraordinary Renaissance maps on the wall of Europe and other areas of great interest to the Holy See, and then enter the meeting rooms, the office areas of the Vatican, where on any given day you may be in a room, again, with extraordinary Renaissance fresco, most magnificent sort of marble floors, occasionally a rather ordinary office where sort of real business is done.
I must say that on the rare occasions I've been into the Secretariat of State, they always take me into a reception room with nice upholstery, but no papers lying around. I think they're a bit worried about the leaks they've had recently.
Yes, you don't find papers lying around, it's quite true. And on the whole, they prefer to operate not by email. I mean, I can send emails to contacts in the Holy See and get a reply, but they pretend to be fairly cautious about the way that they manage paper, they manage the information that they have. I think one thing is worth remembering is that it's actually quite a small operation at the centre. I think often the image of the Holy See is this very large, all competent organization with its global contacts and global networks. Well, the global networks certainly exist, but actually at the center, there aren't many. I would say there may be about 30 or 40 individuals effectively running the equivalent to a foreign ministry. Well, the British Foreign Office has a couple of thousand. So they're working very hard, and I think often working, it's quite difficult for them to manage the flows of information that all foreign ministries have to deal with.
What about the actual physical business of the Vatican City State, the post office? Do you ever use the post office or the commissary, the supermarket? Do you buy your cheap petrol in the Vatican?
I like to use the supermarket occasionally. My wife certainly is keen to get down there. You have to get there very early because the main customers are priests and nuns, and they tend to get up very early as well. So if you want to beat the rush, you've got to be down there about 7 o'clock in the morning. It's rather a thrill, just very occasionally there is actually meat from the Pope's own farm, which you can buy. Otherwise, it's rather like a Waitrose, I suppose. And as all British ambassadors at the moment, I'm keen to support British exports. And if I can get a few more British goods into the papal supermarket, I'd be delighted.
And what about the image of the Pope himself? How often do you see the Pope?
All ambassadors, when they first present their credentials, when they arrive at the city, have the opportunity of a private conversation with the Pope, which I did up at Castel Gandolfo, half an hour or so, a chance to talk about a range of different issues. I found it very interesting in the United Kingdom, of course, given his visit, his very successful visit to Britain in September 2010, very interested in the Church of England, the royal family, and I think with a sense of the importance of Britain for the Holy See, although it's not traditionally considered a Catholic country, certainly not since Henry VIII in any case. Otherwise, usually if we have important visitors who have the opportunity for a call on the Pope, senior ministers, members of the royal family, religious leaders, then I will often accompany them, as I did recently with a ministerial delegation led by Baroness Wasi, for example. And events at which the Pope attends, and a recent event with the Archbishop of Canterbury, for example. The Pope also attends a number of events with the diplomatic corps as a whole. He gives an annual address on the state of the world to the diplomatic corps, and we have the chance to meet him then. So I think, given his very extremely busy agenda, and the fact he's an 85-year-old man as well, I think he makes himself quite accessible and quite available.
And finally, what future do you see for the Vatican today? It's under attack for the paedophile priest crisis, for relations with Muslims. The Pope's certainly got a lot on his plate. Do you think that the Vatican is going to survive into the 21st, 22nd, 23rd centuries? The future, how do you see the future of the Vatican?
The Vatican has a perspective based in centuries rather than in months or even decades. I think they have a long-term survival plan that is particularly linked to the growth of the Catholic Church in parts of the world that are not the traditional homelands of the Catholic Church. I'm thinking of Africa and Asia, for example, where the Catholic Church is actually growing quite strongly. I think part of the survival plan, part of the adjustment to the modern world, is emphasizing increasingly that the global nature, the outside of Europe, the beyond Europe nature of the Catholic Church. And I think that's actually crucial to that role. There are always going to be short-term crises and difficulties, some greater than others. I mean, clearly, the clerical child sex abuse scandal created enormous damage to the reputation and image of the Church. And I think quite rightly, because for a long while they didn't manage to get a grip of it. I think they have been doing so recently, and I think these sort of issues are ones that they have to learn to manage, to respond to understand that they are in a media world, that the old days of Vatican secrecy, the secret archive, close diplomacy held amongst only small elites, those days have gone, and they need to open up as far as possible. They now have a website, they now engage on Twitter, they're on social media, they are improving the transparency of Vatican institutions. I think that is all absolutely crucial for the survival of the administrative operation, the Vatican City State and the Holy See, going into the 22nd and 23rd centuries.
That was David Willey speaking to Nigel Baker, the UK's ambassador to the Holy See. And now it's back to Geneva. We also met up with Rufus Yerxa, Deputy Director General of the WTO, and asked him why he thinks the Swiss city is a perfect place for his organisation to be.
We obviously like Geneva very much. It's our headquarters city. It's a great place for an international organisation to be located because it is such an international city with the UN headquarters, with a very large international population. By the way, with a very big multinational business community as well. Because as you know, lots and lots of not just European, not just Swiss companies or European companies, but companies globally have headquarters here or have their European operations here. And so, you know, to a city like Geneva, I would argue the WTO is also very important. If you think about some of the commercial products that Geneva is known for, like watches, high quality watches. There's manufacturing all around the area, but Geneva has become sort of the center in terms of marketing, advertising, design, many other things. And so an industry like that, which has been very successful in world trade, couldn't have prospered if we hadn't succeeded in getting the barriers down all around the world for importing watches. And that's made Geneva a successful exporter of watches. But I think back to your broader question about, to what extent we see these large cities very much kind of defining what their national position might be in these negotiations. That's certainly very true. And if you take just examples in Europe, you take the big successful manufacturing centers and you look at a city like Paris and the influence it has over French national economic policy, or if you take Milan and Turin and you know, maybe to a lesser extent, actually, Rome, the influence they have on Italy's view about the global marketplace and global trade rules. Sometimes you have big states like the United States where you will find that maybe the interests are somewhat different in different regions, and they may have conflicting interests. And the best example I could give is the view that might persist in certain cities in the industrial heartland of the United States, which was traditionally the manufacturing base. So the upper Midwest, cities like Detroit and Chicago and others, if you take their interests versus maybe the coastal ports or the South, where you have a lot of a city like Houston with a very big petroleum and petrochemical industry. And very often they might be somewhat in different positions with respect to the trade-offs that might be contemplated by the U.S. in a negotiation like the WTO negotiations. So that's sometimes there are conflicts or tension between cities about what the national policy should be. I would argue that by and large, urban areas tend to be centers of not just manufacturing, but also innovation. It's where a lot of the intellectual capacity of the country exists. So what goes into the, you know, to the design and the invention of products is very often dependent on urban areas with higher education and quality of life and things that, you know, attract people to work in those kinds of settings. And so by and large, I think if you did polling in urban areas about attitudes towards trade, you'd find it slightly different than maybe it would be in rural areas.
For you, Geneva as a city brand, how does it work for the World Trade Organization? What makes it a good place for you to be based?
Historically, Switzerland was viewed as a neutral city, a neutral country, I should say, and Geneva was certainly viewed as the sort of seat of diplomacy in Switzerland. I mean, Zurich was the financial and commercial center. Basel had a lot of the manufacturing. Bern was the capital, but Geneva was the city of diplomacy. And in fact, if you look at the first sort of international agreements that Geneva hosted, they go well back to the middle of the 19th century. And so what evolved here was, first of all, culture that was oriented around international diplomacy, multilateral diplomacy. What does that mean? It means, you know, we're a city with lots and lots of people with that kind of knowledge and experience, but also, just for example, translators and interpreters. No international organization can work without people who have all those good translating and interpreting skills, people who know how to run an international organization and an international secretariat. Right up the hill from the WTO, you obviously have the Geneva headquarters of the UN, and there are more UN employees in Geneva than in New York. So, you know, Geneva's been very, very successful. It's has branded itself as this city for multilateral diplomacy. We have an extremely good relationship with both the Swiss government and the cantonal government and the city of Geneva. We're in the process of renovating and expanding our headquarters here. A lot of the funding for that came from the Swiss. That's not always, you'd think in some countries it wouldn't be popular to use national revenues to pay for an international organization. But I think the Swiss are quite intelligent about this. They realize that it's in their long-term interest to enhance that reputation, enhance that sort of trademark of Geneva as a city for international diplomacy. They've certainly done what it takes to keep the WTO here, and it's been a very good relationship.
That was me speaking to Rufus Yerxa in Geneva. Well, that's all for today's special cities segment. I'm Andrew Tuck. But tomorrow, I'm going to be back looking at play cities. And now, to see you out, here's a song. This is Diplomat's Son by Vampire Weekend.
It's not right, but it's now or never.